It's Mark Tui and Scott Reed in for Rush Minair on The Rush this afternoon. It's time for our Smart Speakers segment, where some of the city's smartest speakers join us to go through the stories of the day, including that one, John Tory, one of many speakers who explained the plan for making you feel safer and you actually be safer on transit in Toronto. Our speakers today, Bruce Arthur, Toronto-based columnist for the Toronto Star, and Laura Babcock of Power Group Communications and host of the show. Let's start with Bruce. Are they on the right track here? They listed a whole bunch of things, from bringing in off-duty cops to bolster the uniform presence, doing the same with special constables, adding cameras, putting more even non-security related uniformed TTC staff throughout the system. Is that going to work?
I mean, work is a subjective thing. It might give people a slightly more of a sense of security if you see more security around in the TTC. But what was the number that John Tory said today? 80 police officers spread across the transit system that carries about 1 million people a day. You could double that. You could triple that. And you still, the problem you get with what's happening right now, and it's not just in the TTC. We need to make that crystal clear. TTC is just the locus of it right now. Talk to someone who works in an emergency department about random attacks and you'll get a whole bunch of stories. But in terms of the TTC, when we talk about what we're trying to deal with, these are by definition random attacks, which means it can happen, is not likely to happen, but can happen on any subway car, on any bus, on any streetcar. So there's unless you put a security person on every single ride, you're not going to wipe this out. You can, however, potentially, maybe in terms of some of the attacks, you might be able to dissuade people from doing it, like teens shooting up a TTC station with a BB gun. But like, this is a reactionary attack to a societal problem that we don't fully understand yet. We don't have the background for every single one of these attacks. We just know it's happening. So this is probably marginally, maybe better than nothing.
Laura, do you agree with that? Or, you know, would you say, listen, every journey starts with one step, and they had to do something given the rash of attacks that had occurred, and plunging confidence you're hearing, at least anecdotally from people, about the safety and the sense of security on TTC?
Well, I mean, not just anecdotally, right? We've got people running with a syringe, people lighting people on fire, shootings, stabbings. I mean, the stories are horrific. And the fact that a TTC, a subway driver, went off about the state of the TTC, you know, just goes to show the level of fear and frustration that everybody is feeling. They need to flood the zone. And I mean, not just flood the zone in terms of having more enforcement around to be able to protect passengers, but flood the zone in terms of public confidence. They need to be doing PSAs. They have to show that they are taking extra steps. This is not just, you know, a political issue for tourists anymore, or it might happen, may not happen. This is making people, regular users of the TTC, afraid to use the TTC. I said to my daughter, next time you're in Toronto visiting the cousins, I don't want you on the TTC. Not until we see that they're making a serious effort to this. And in terms of what was just said, I mean, I loved the comment. It was actually from the CEO of the TTC saying that the TTC is a microcosm of society. And I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I remember talking to a woman who survived in Afghanistan, and she does therapy now, and she says that the worst PTSD comes out after the height of the crisis. So if you think about it, we're sort of in the third year, are we, of the pandemic. Now we're starting to see the incredible weight that that had on our homeless population, on people struggling with mental illness, on affordability. I mean, there are a lot of things going on, but some of it is predictable and we need to deal with it.
Bruce Arthur, an NDP MPP, came out today calling for more speed cameras, radar-triggered speed cameras across the city of Toronto. I'll point out that, she was saying that there are 50 across the city. City Council already in November sort of approved an additional 25. I'm somewhat skeptical, though. I think this is more politics than public safety, and I point to the fact that they're being distributed and have been in past evenly amongst each of the wards, so every councillor gets the same opportunity to sort of pose for one in their community newsletter. Is this going to make us safer?
I will say this. When you put a speed camera near a school, or you put a speed camera pretty much on any street, I personally run exactly the speed limit past it. So they'd work in those, in the small places where you do it. The problem you get in Toronto. Well, the problem you get with speed cameras is people have, like, people who aren't libertarians become libertarians all of a sudden. Well, how dare you catch me driving faster than the speed limit? Because most people in a lot of situations do. Now, the problem you get in Toronto is we don't have great enforcement of our traffic laws, man. We just don't. And we have a lot of really terrible and, as a result, careless drivers. So I'm actually fine, even though I occasionally will drive faster than the speed limit. I'm fine with more speed cameras because the thing is, they work.
Laura, I'm the guy Bruce was just talking about. I'm the guy who goes, "Damn it! What is this in the mail? No one caught me. They didn't track me down. They didn't Columbo my ass and find out that I was going 11 kilometers higher than the speed limit. They just eye in the sky'd me." So I have that reaction. But I also have the reaction of yelling and screaming at people, Uber Eats drivers that are blasting down my residential street at 110 kilometers an hour. So I ask you this specific question, Ms. Babcock: speed cameras or speed bumps? Because I think speed bumps is a solution. That'll make me slow down, but I won't get nabbed by the eye in the sky.
Can we have both? Can I take A and B?
No, no, no. I'm in charge.
Listen, Toronto had less pedestrian deaths. In part, they're crediting because of Vision Zero kind of starting to work than they have previously, which is a great start. But the difference in the damage and the fatalities by speed, right? Like, 10, 20 kilometers an hour can make a real difference in how a child might survive getting hit or a cyclist. So anything that makes us not go below the speed limit, but just, follow the law. I know it's an inconvenience, but if you're not speeding, you don't have to worry about those cameras catching you. There'll be nothing in the mail. Just go the speed limit that's posted.
This brings me to my second concern with the NDP MPP's publicity effort here. And you just touched on it, Laura. The Vision Zero campaign kicked off in 2016, got fully underway 2019 with 2.0 in Toronto. But if you look at the stats from the Toronto Police Service, I don't know where the MPP gets her numbers, but the killed or significantly injured incidents with pedestrians actually went up when Vision Zero began. She points to, oh my God, we're way over the trend this month compared to last year, but last year was inordinately low because of pandemic, and the data supports that. But we had far fewer injuries and deaths of pedestrians before Vision Zero started, the 3 years before. It dropped weirdly for some reason. Maybe it was the way they counted them.
Yeah, so I mean, Vision Zero is an experiment, right? And they're gonna keep kind of looking at all of the factors that play into it: driver behavior and traffic calming measures, the speed bumps we talked about, traffic light awareness too. Exactly what is the cost of getting that extra minute in on your drive home, vis-a-vis the harm it causes other people who are just trying to get to work or just kids trying to get home from school. So I think Vision Zero is too early to condemn. I think it's something that it's better than not trying it, right? I'm still looking to see the progress on this thing.
All right. That's the last word on that topic, although I will say that some logical and potentially well-informed texter sent into the station the point that speed bumps actually damage a lot of vehicles, even at the speed limit or lower.
Especially when you're speeding.
And they interfere with emergency vehicles and snowplows. So I guess, my grand plan maybe is getting pushed back. We're going to come back in just a few minutes. We're sticking with the smart speakers. We're going to talk about cancer ants or ants that hunt cancer. We're going to have ants crawl over you. Presumably you're covered in jam. I don't really understand if it's supposed to be good for your health. And we're going to get the opinion of both Bruce and Laura on that topic. Also want to mention tomorrow on the Jerry Agar Show at 11:35 a.m., Mayor Scarpetti is going to be here to talk about the tax increase in Markham and how he wants to put the boots to Doug Ford's house building bill.
There's fighting words right there.
You got it. So don't miss that. Mark Toohey, Scott Reed will be right back after the traffic. Welcome back, Scott Reed and Mark Toohey, bringing you home on this Thursday afternoon. We are right smack dab in the center of our Smart Speakers segment, where we bring in two of the best and brightest from all the way across Toronto to talk with you about the big issues of the day. We got Bruce Arthur, Toronto-based columnist of the Toronto Star. I'm glad you're not, Mars-based Toronto columnist for the Toronto Star, and Laura Babcock of Power Group Communications, host of the O Show. All right, I'm going to attempt. Okay, guys, I'm going to butcher
this. I want to hear you explain.
I'm going to butcher this because I did not, for the life of me, understand it. We talked to this guy who wrote this very learned, thoughtful article about the fact that there are ants that now can detect by sniffing urine whether, in fact, that sample comes from somebody who may have cancer. And so we've heard of, you know, Mark made the point, you know, cancer sniffing dogs, and now it appears we have cancer sniffing ants. And I for the life of me, I couldn't understand it, because I'm like, well, like, don't I want to test? Do I really want to leave it up to the ant? They go, well, the ant says you have cancer. And I'm like, well, is that it? Do I just go into chemo tomorrow? Like, could I get a test? And if I can get a test, shouldn't I just take the test in the first place? Why in hell do we need the ant anyway? But I don't know. Are you excited about this, Laura?
I am. I have a dermatologist appointment tomorrow. I've waited 9 months for. Hell yes, I am. Anything that we can do to use the natural abilities around us, right? So dogs sniffing certain.
Why? Use the natural ability of an ant? Why not just take a test and be freaking sure based on medical science?
9 freaking months to get the appointment with the dermatologist. This is what I'm saying. If you think that you can just find something on your body and immediately get in front of the expert who can really help you with it, that's not what we have currently in our healthcare system. So throw anything at the mix that works. If a dog can sniff it and jump you ahead in the queue because the dog can confirm that they've smelled it, or ants, do it. They're cheap, they're fast, they're easy to train, according to this brilliant man in Paris who did this during the pandemic in his apartment, figured this out.
Great, like,
why not use natural resources around us to speed this stuff up?
Bruce Arthur, I don't know how old you are, but I'm of a certain age where I should have had one or two colonoscopies by now, and I have not, because I just not that interested in finding out that information that particular way. But if I could pee in a bottle and have an ant tested, I presume ants are cheaper to feed and house than dogs. So I see the utility in this.
Okay, one, you should have a colonoscopy. It's important. My brother-in-law just said it. It's an important thing to do. It's not fun, but it's really the preparation that's the least fun part. Second, bring on the ants. There are more ants than humans on the planet, and if some of them can be trained to do something actually useful, then that would be terrific. The third one is this, and this is a bit of a side issue, but I think it's related. I was talking to an emergency room doctor today, and they said that diagnosing patients is about 10 times as complex as it was even 10 years ago, because people are living longer, they're identifying more drugs and more diseases, and so it takes longer to get through patients. So all that thing of how you actually diagnose cancer, how a patient moves through the system is partly having problem. Healthcare systems all over the world do, because we have an aging population, and your ability to get that test is eventually it's slowing down and it's harder to do. So if we can introduce ants to the system that can, as this guy claims, be easily trained and can reliably sniff out cancer faster and quicker than the stuff that costs a lot of money for our healthcare systems that are already buckling, give me the ants. It's like that Kent Brockman thing. I for one, hail our new ant overlords.
I don't know. Great.
But will it take less than 9 months to get an appointment with the ants? Because you know ants, once they become crucial, they get real uppity.
I'm sorry, Mr. Reed. The ant thinks you have cancer. We've referred you now to the hamster, and eventually you will work your way to a doctor. I'm going to stick with you, Bruce, because I know you've got, like me, about 77 children. And this isn't... I think it's kind of an interesting question. I hadn't thought a lot about it, but when the question's posed to me, I kind of went, bing, you know, the old light bulb comes on. And the question is, are kids' sleepovers on the wane? You know, post-pandemic, are we finding out that, you know, parents are saying, I'm not as keen on that? Is it, you know, in a world of, you know, all sorts of, you know, harms and stuff, are people getting a little more reticent to let kids spend the night at a friend's place? Is it a health issue? Is it a, you know, public consciousness issue? Do your kids have sleepovers? I forget what ages they are, but you guys still got a couple young ones, right?
We have 13, 13, 11, and 7.
Okay.
I'm not reticent for the same reason that it would have been not reticent before the pandemic. If your kid is sick or their kid is sick, then you don't do stuff together, and that's just kind of how things are now,
More
so than it used to be. I would say in terms of sending your kid over there in this era, you have to kind of trust two things. You have to trust the people that you're sending the kid that you're sending the kid there to their house, but you also have to trust your kid to know what's wrong, to know what to watch for, to tell you that that something bad has happened, right? And so I don't think it's a huge issue, or not something that we have come across. I can understand it, though, because there is, beyond even the pandemic, especially in the United States, I would say there's a breakdown of societal trust along political lines. I'm not sure it's quite the same in Canada, but I think that's something that happens in the States. And I could see that being a casualty in a wider societal way. I just haven't run into it myself.
Laura Babcock, I mean, part of the reason why the author sort of says some people are reticent about letting their kids go to neighbors or friends for a sleepover is fear that they might run into something like fentanyl, disputes over whether you should be vaccinated, whether you should wear masks. But generally speaking, you know, is there a sense that we just don't know our kids' friends and their parents as much as we might have when I was a child? And so we don't really know where we're sending them.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, in the 70s, didn't we do everything and go everywhere? I certainly did. But now,
with no seatbelts.
Yeah, exactly. My kids can't go to sleepovers unless they are either a very close family friend, like almost like they're, you know, honorary aunt and uncle or you know, that kind of close relationship or family. And we said that to them early and often because for a whole host of reasons, you don't know the dynamic in the home. You don't, especially with the stress of the pandemic, to the point we just heard about the fact that any conversation these days can feel extremely spiky and awkward. I have to tell my kids sometimes when we go to group things, you know, there's some friends here who are, you know, anti-Trudeau or this or that or anti-vax or whatever. We don't need to make it a political thing today. Let's just go have fun. So we didn't used to have to do that, right? But the sleepover thing, they're in someone's house overnight. You can't supervise them. I just have to really, really know the parents very well.
I'm worried about what they'll discover about me. I'm worried that my kid will be like, you know, going through their cupboards and then you'll be like, sorry, dad lets us eat hamburger helper straight out of the carton. Like, what's wrong with you people, right?
Yes, you have to brief them beforehand. Do not talk about this. Do not talk about dinner. Don't talk about breakfast.
Here's the crap we do that others don't. Please behave like a normal person.
But I'll host. I'll host anytime. I don't mind hosting kids. I just won't send my kids.
What age do sleepovers stop? Laura?
Well, you know what? I think they become a little bit of an excuse sometimes to go to the house where the parents have the easy curfews, right? Or the lack of supervision or the older brother's in charge kind of deal. And that's what I remember when I was a teenager. And that's why it's like a no-go with my kids. So I think people stop asking for sleepovers like at 16. It feels a little weird unless it's being used as an excuse to stay all night because the parents aren't around.
Bruce?
I haven't hit that age yet where they've stopped. One thing, though, that this kind of brings up is the idea of helicopter parenting, and I've been totally guilty of this. I think of my childhood, and I would leave the house, and I would come back, and I would leave the house, and I would come back. And I spent way more time, me and all my friends, out in the world than we let our kids do now. And I think this does extend to sleepovers because you worry about everything that could happen. And we as parents are trying to gradually undo that when we can with the knowledge that there are stuff that you really do need to worry about. So it's a delicate balance in terms of how old they're going to be. I think they just change it to, you know, I'm going to stay at Ben's house tonight or whatever, right? And that, again, it'll become trust as they go. You have to trust your kids to make the right decisions as much as you can.
Well, Mark and I are having a sleepover tonight, so no fears on our end. Anything. Bruce Arthur from the Toronto Star, Laura Babcock, Power Group Communications. Thank you both for being our smart speakers today. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.